Greetings, Zimbabwe, Africa, and the world. Welcome to In Conversation with Trevor, brought to you by Titan Law. I go beyond the headlines and beyond the sensational. Today, I'm in conversation with Ntabaziduna Chief Felix Nhlanhlayamangwe Kaisa Ndiweni. Chief Felix Nhlanhlayamangwe Ndiweni, welcome to, that's a mouthful, welcome to In Conversation with Trevor.
Pleasure to be here. Excellent. And it's a wonderful time to meet here.
Excellent. Yeah. We're delighted to have you here. You step into big shoes. Your father, Chief Kaisa Ndiweni, who was chief before you and lived from 1913 to 2010, was a larger-than-life character, controversial in many respects. Tell me, what role did he have in shaping who you are?
He had a profound effect on me. Obviously someone who is your parent, your father, but nonetheless an individual who's been in the office for close on nearly 71 years. So it's rare to come across an individual like that who's in the office, in the work for 71 years. That is a wealth of knowledge and influence they impart on you. The great shaping that it did on me was really its simplicity itself. You have to be a listener. Take time to rationalize things. Take time to understand things. Don't prejudge people. Don't prejudge things and events. Because he always tell me that history has a nasty habit of playing the same song again to you. And if you didn't hear that song the first time, listen well. It will come to you again. So those are the great things that he imparted over to me. So even if he was in the hustle and bustle. I mean, when I was reading up some articles about him clashing with the then Prime Minister Ian Douglas-Smith on many occasions, being threatened with court actions on many occasions, it did not fluster him. He was not troubled because he was a rational individual. And he was a man of faith and spirituality and Ubuntu, all rolled into one. So for him, he imparted into me that being a chief means that you have a higher calling that really puts your personality, your being, second fiddle to this role that you've been given. And yes, I saw it. I saw it on a day-to-day.
And he clashed with Robert Mugabe?
Yes, ferociously. Ferociously. He clashed with him head-on, on principle, on beliefs, on theory, on government, on all those things, because he had a long-term view of what this nation should be, of where we should be going as a people. He did not, yes, of course, he recognized the office of president, but when things come down to it, you must be able to engage with that incumbent of that office to say, we have a different way of doing things. Would like to do things in a different way. So it was a principled engagement with him.
And he started the United Federal, National Federal Party. He was very, he was a federalist in a way.
Yes, indeed he was. He was a federalism really at the hardcore. His federal principles came out when he got an invitation from the then government of West Germany to come over and see federalism in Germany and how they've done it. And they've done it in a wonderful way, whereby really it is the trickle-down effect. Central government is central, and it trickles down. That does not work all the time. So you turn the whole thing upside down and say, let me empower the local people. After all, it's the local people that know how they want to live. whatever they want to do, the things they want to do them, the legislation, the way of life, the medication, the schools, all those things people know. Hence for him, and also me, myself as well, I subscribe to that, to say that really it is the people on the ground that know best how to govern themselves.
Interesting. Correct me, my reading around as I was researching says that Chief Kaisen Dueni, your father, was not the firstborn. So he was made a chief, even though he was not the firstborn.
Yes.
Explain to me the precedent and how far that goes back.
Yes. I think sometimes we tend to rush these things and we tend to try and think we understand it totally. How the chieftaincy succession happens, whether you're looking at from the southern part of Zimbabwe, which is father to son, father to son, father to son. In that arena, you're looking at saying, well, okay, to son, which son it is that you're looking for. It is not naturally all the time the firstborn son that becomes chief in a chieftaincy succession, or even in a monarchy succession with the Kumalo clan. It is only one criteria that you're addressing. That child is born first, the firstborn son. Then follows another test for that son. That son's character, their conduct, their morality, all those things come into play. So, yes, you pass the first criteria of being the firstborn son, but the remainder of it, do you really actually fit that office? Because you have to govern people. You have to be able to lead those people. So every single chieftaincy, every single royal family has that second part of the criteria to say, is that person fit for that? Mm. For the late Chief Kaisen Dueni, my father, he was not the firstborn son. The firstborn son was Ubaba Unzeche. Mm-hmm. Ubaba Unzeche, why Lolaga? Why Chaya Bant? Why Natu Chwala? Why Jile?
Right.
Elolaga, a child wanting his go to his ingaga for minor things.
Explain that to our viewers who don't understand the bele.
Yes, translating it over, I was saying my grandfather, older grandfather, Nzeche, he had a temper. He was a hard drinker. He was a womanizer. He was a rabble rouser. Everything the Ndwini clan did not want a chief to be.
That disqualified him.
It immediately disqualified him. So when it disqualified him on that score to be a chief, even though he was the firstborn son, the elders, the clan Ndwenis, stood up and they went to Cholocho to pick up the young Kaisen Ndweni from school, brought him back from Cholocho to Ndawa Zinduna in the presence of Unzeche and the others to say, we will enthrone him as the chief of Ndawa Zinduna. So it is those calibers, those issues that...
Had there been a precedent before?
Within the clan, the Ndwini clan, the Tambo clan, that precedent goes back at least 2 to 3 generations in the back. Right. So Chief Kaisen Ndwini was not the first. He was following a well-established precedent. And even if you say, here's the Ndwini clan of Ndawa Zinduna, there's a bigger precedent. If you say the Ndwini clan, we are from the greater Amangwe clan. We have a reigning monarch right now today, Inkosi Mangete, the King Mangete in South Africa. He is also not the firstborn. Even if we go to the Kumalo royal family, Mbulazi, Mzilikazi was not the firstborn. Lobengula was not the firstborn. So there's always this criteria that comes in, that kicks in, to say God has given you the grace to be firstborn. But qualify your character.
Interesting. You've spoken about the role that your dad had in shaping you.
Yeah.
What about your mom?
My mom has a huge role.
Explain that to us.
A powerful role. She's my mother, she's translating over, in Lovgaz, Queen Mother. Her role really is the rock and the foundation within the chieftaincy. Many people have a warped idea about feminism when it's coming over to the African context. if you're reading books from Germaine Greer and others there, they may say maybe feminism in Africa is downtrodden, the male figure is too powerful. But in true culture, in true tradition, it is the mother that looks after the whole chieftaincy. The mother in her quietness, in her silentness, sitting in the corner there or going about her job, will actually enthrone the chief, because she knows the whole family. She knows everything about that chieftaincy, quietly.
She knows the character of her children.
She knows the character of the children. But more important than that, Baba Ncube, it is the fact that the whole community gravitates to her. If you want to have a silent word, that you'd want that word to reach the chief, go through the mother, go through the ladies. It is the ladies who will mold that difficult issue that you have and present it to the chief. And when they present it to the chief, then it will be acceptable. But if you ignore the mothers, you will have a hard time. Because that issue that she could have taken for you to the chief will arrive at the chief in a horrible way. You want to marry somebody's daughter. Pass it through the mother so the chief gets to hear it in a nice way where it's been buttered and molded.
Pillow talk?
Pillow talk. Mm. Pillow talk. She's the one who can do that. Mm. Here, Baba Nkosiyami, so-and-so wants to get married to so-and-so. I think it would be wonderful.
So it's very good to be in good books with her.
That is it. That is the only way through. And even putting it on a historical context, when there was the Matabeleland revolt, first and second, down in the southern part of the country, it is Cecil Rhodes who finally understood it, and he went through the women folk to get to the men folk. That is why the ceasefire was called at Motopos Hills, because it came through. They told Cecil Rhodes to say, if you want to approach our men folk, present yourself unarmed. Disarm yourself. Because these are people, these are warriors. They will not attack you if you are disarmed. And he did that. And that is how the talks began.
You were born in 1965, and you have a fascinating upbringing. You moved to London in 1981. Mm-hmm. And you worked as an auditor for Waltham Forest Council.
Yes, I did.
What were the highlights of that? Did you walk around the streets of Waltham, Waltham Forest, thinking Waltham Forest, one day I'm going to come back and be a chief?
No, I didn't. To start at the beginning, I know it's been reported in the media that I was born in 1965. I was born in 1963.
Okay.
So it's an error that came into the media that likes that.
Thanks for that correction.
Yes.
Yeah.
But within Waltham Forest, which is in the east side of London, there I was actually a street crime warden. The auditor stopped taking I did prior to that.
Uh-huh.
So in Waltham Forest there, I was doing things like community cohesion and diversity, and also looking at the low-level crime that's around there, looking at drug issues, drug gangs, yardies, prostitution, all those kind of things. I was the first link within the police arena whereby they were trying to look for a softer touch into the local community, especially the communities that felt as if they were being pushed out of the normal society in London, to find a way to engage those. So yes, we would identify a gang, a street gang. I would go there, I would find a way to get into them. I'll try and find how the street gang operates, who are the weak links in it, can I get into those weak links, and gently but surely bring them over out of the hard things which they were doing and bring them into a normal society and an everyday society.
How long did you do this for?
I did it for about 5 to 6 years.
5 to 6 years.
Yes.
Has it shaped the way you operate as a chief at all?
It has, because obviously it put me in the forefront. It put me in the forefront in a dangerous situation. Mm. It put me in the forefront in a difficult situation. So a large component of that role involved things like mediation, conflict resolution, dealing with tricky, difficult situations. If Wilson Brown does not want to talk to you, you need to find a way of how to talk to him. even if he's coming from a very hard position, whereby, Ndwene, I really do not like you, I don't want to talk to you, I had to find a way of coming around to eventually talking to him. So obviously it has shaped me as a person in this role, that really I cannot have no-go areas. I have to engage people. Mm. I have to talk to people. So really it shaped me in a strong way.
Fascinating as I was looking at reading around you, mm-hmm. That President Robert Mugabe had mm-hmm. no qualms about you being Dawa's Nduna chief.
Yes.
Talk to me about that.
Yes, he had no qualms about it. The Ndwene clan put together all the paperwork that was required. We followed due diligence in procedure and protocol of how a chief is given that substantial chief record by the president. And it came to his table, and from what we've heard, he stamped it so quickly because everything was in order. Now, after that, which is after 2014, what came into play was politics. The political arena from different corners had issues, had various issues that they would like to try and do.
Okay, so before we go in there, so the papers go to the President Robert Mugabe, stamps them quickly, he's happy with the papers.
Yes.
September 2014, you are installed.
Yes.
At a ceremony where there are chiefs from South Africa and so forth. Describe that to us in a nutshell.
That really was something that obviously I did not plan. It was planned by the elders. When you find yourself in that position, you are just basically an individual just removed from A to B to C to D. They're the ones in charge of that whole area. They did something profoundly heavy. Baleta inkosi yamangwe. Translated, they brought the king of the Amangwe clan.
Mm-hmm.
Flew him all the way from Vryheid, KwaZulu-Natal. To do a ceremony, Baba Trevor Lapa, which has not been done in this country in 126 years.
Wow.
We're talking deep history here, historical.
Mm.
He performed the ceremony, which I cannot divulge for cultural reasons.
We respect that. We respect that.
But it was the first time a reigning monarch lifted up a new chief, a new ghost. Has not been done in this country in 126 years.
So you were installed
in the
amazing beauty that you describe, deep culture and everything else.
Yes.
And then you have your brother Joram going to court to challenge an EGET application to challenge your installation.
Yes.
Why is dear brother Joram doing this?
I think one of the things that came over that whole issue was part of the political arrangements that come in, whereby, and I think it's fair to say...
And let's clarify, Joram is your elder brother.
Joram is the elder brother.
Yeah.
My elder brother here. He is the firstborn in our family via the chief and my mother, Masubu.
Mm-hmm.
He's the firstborn in that family there. And then after Joram followed seven girls, and then came myself.
Okay, so he goes to court to challenge your installation.
He goes to court to challenge the installation. It is on the basis of being the firstborn son, and really that is the only basis that comes through. But then again, the documentation that came through showed that there were politics coming into that, because even if you're claiming to say, on the grounds of my being firstborn son, I need to be chief, then one could easily say, well, actually, he's not the firstborn son. We have another brother who was not my mother's son, but he was the firstborn son of the late Chief Ndwene.
Mm.
He's called Mahlabizulu. He's alive, he's well, we work together. He saw me off at the airport this morning when I was coming here. He's actually older than Joram. Mm. So even if someone wants to try and challenge the issue to say, firstborn son must always be there, I will be pushing the card to say, here's Mahlabizulu.
Mm.
What do you say about him on that? Mm. But with that one there, Trevor, really, it came, I think, the impetus for that urgent chamber application came from the political arena.
Mm.
It was ill-informed, ill-advised.
It didn't succeed.
It didn't succeed because really its grounds that it had, and even the grounds that it has even today, do not hold water culturally and historically and legally.
You have the support of your mother, and we just highlighted how important mothers are.
Yeah.
Your mother Agnes supports you. Your sister Lydia supports you and some relatives.
Yeah.
And it looks like you do have the support of the community. How much comfort does that give you?
It gives one a great deal of comfort, because really, if you're doing a job, and irrespective of myself, but anyone, anywhere in the world, if you're doing a job, it would be nice to know that people support you in that job. So for Ntaba Zinduna, we have the support of the Greater Ndwene clan. We have the support of the whole Amangwe clan going further there. We have the support also of now His Majesty, King Bulelani Khumalo, from the Khumalo clan. That's also there. But also more closer to home. Every chief, in it, every traditional chief from this part of the country had to be a commander of a regiment. Mm-hmm. The regiment that we in Ndwenis in Ntaba Zinduna used to command was called the Nhlamba Baloyi Regiment. Just like Wabu Khumalo Mtshana commanded the Mbizo Regiment. So for myself, the Nhlamba Baloyi Regiment, for want of a better word, supports me wholeheartedly, is there. Hence, really, I'm not too worried or fazed by the tabloids when they go off to say challenges and clashes amongst the Ndwene clan. And
there's nothing of that sort.
They want to sell
papers. You sleep well.
They want to sell papers, Baba. It is a cunning, cunning sales pitch.
We'll get to the politics, but now I want us to focus on what's a day like in the life of a chief? What are the challenging things? What are the stuff that you look forward to?
I think really the role of a chief has changed profoundly over the decades. Nowadays, really, it is a hothouse. And here in our country, we still have a lot of work to do to make that hothouse work. Mm. For myself, I'm normally up at about 5 in the morning, 5 a.m. Not that I want to get up, but being woken up by people. People who've been traveling maybe for 2 to 3 hours at night to get to me to report. Mrs. Dube, my husband, got drunk last night. He was unruly towards me, was beating me up, doing all sorts of things. I have to start dealing with that straight away from that very urgent moment. Mm-hmm. The next moment I'll be dealing with something in the local schools, whether there's a whole group of people who've not managed to pay the school fees. How can I coax them, encourage them to pay the school fees? From then onwards, I have to deal with local government who's coming in with issues, or the local police coming up with issues. But I don't know whether a lot of people, Trevor, understand that when you're a chief and you're actually a proactive chief, everything that happens on your turf, in your area, you are responsible for. That's what the government of the day has said. So whether you're looking at schools, healthcare, clinic, agriculture,
domestic issues,
whatever it is lumped towards you for you to deal. That's why if you come to Ntaba Zinduna, I do not have office hours. Someone can come to me at the dead of night or at midday. I have to attend to those people. So every day is completely different. There are no 2 days which are the same.
And then the you get challenged, rather suspended, by the Matabele North traditional leaders, provincial assembly, on the grounds that your chieftainship is being contested. After what you've just explained to us, where is this coming from?
I would say my colleagues, they I think they were rounded on. Because really, there's nothing new to talk about. And even when I hear the feedback from some of my colleagues, letters from 209 were being read out, 2010 were being read out. These were all letters that were already read before, found to have no validity, and chucked away. Just to give you a snapshot of how the process works. The Ndwene clan sit down. They talk to say who is going to be the successor to the late chief. When they come to an understanding, they take that whole file to the district assistants and give it over to say, we have completed our work. The district assistants takes the same file to the provincial administrator to say, we've completed everything. The provincial administrator takes that file to the Minister of Local Government, who has portfolio responsibilities for chiefs, and hands it over to them to say, the Ndwini clan have completed all the work. Here it is. Through that whole process, it's being sifted and verified. When it goes from there, it goes to the Matabeleland North Chiefs Council. They also sift it and verify it. When they're happy with it, they take it to the National Chiefs Council. They sift it and verify it. After that, it is taken to the Attorney General, who he sifts it and verifies it. After the Attorney General is happy with it, he takes it to the President's office and sifts it and verifies it. So it is highly unlikely, Baba Trevor, it's highly unlikely, highly improbable, that through all those layers I've just been going through, one letter got through or was not read or not verified. So I think it's one of those misnomers that happened in the meeting there. And when they say suspended, technically that's not true also, because there was no letter written out to say, Chief Nguyen, here's the letter, you're now suspended.
So what is the correct position?
The correct position, as my lawyers said when I was talking about it, they said, Chief Nguyen, that was just a conversation in the bar. The chiefs were having a conversation in the bar.
Right.
It has no legal bearing. It has no legal merit. It changes absolutely nothing at all.
So as we sit here, you are legitimately the chief of Chief Kaisanduwen of Ntawa Zinduna.
Very much so, Trevor. Mm. Very much so. And for that to change, the amazing thing is that for that to change, the president of the country has to put together a commission of inquiry regarding the chieftaincy of Ntawa Zinduna. But even then, they can't do that there, because whilst there is an incumbent chief, it is difficult to put that commission together. But here's the crux. Even if he did that, he has to work in collaboration with the Ndwini clan in Ntawa Zinduna. If the Ndwini clan do not agree with the president of the day, then the president of the day does not get his wish. It all spins on that, because this is a strange job. It is the only job that I know of whereby you get that job according to your blood type. If you are not Ndwini, Trevor, you cannot be a chief of the Ndwinis.
Okay. You've criticized the government over plans to evict commercial farmers,
yes,
the Parsons and the Davis.
Very much so, yes.
Could you, in a nutshell, explain what that was all about? And could this be the genesis of your problems?
It definitely is, Baba, it definitely is. You know, when you fight with somebody, like we did in the past historically, we've got a little place there in Ntawa Zinduna called Gadad. Technically, Gadad should be the first hero's acre in Zimbabwe. It is where King Lobengula's Mbizo regiment, the main regiment in his armed forces, clashed with the first colony of mercenaries that came to this place. They were carrying machine guns. It was a clash of nations, a clash of cultures, a clash of races, a clash of everything. The Mbizo regiment on that day fell in 1893, November. When the Mbizo regiment fell, that was the end of King Lobengula's reign, technically, because his main regiment had fallen. But after such a clash, you then become brothers in arms with the people you fought. Anyone who's fought huge battles will tell you that after the ceasefire is called, you become brothers in arms. So when we come zipping forward to 2019 and we're talking about the Parsons family on top of Ntaba Zinduna. It is right that they are there. It is right that the Parson families are there, because we became brothers in arms. Ntaba Zinduna Mountain has a huge meaning to the Ndebele nation in the southern part of Zimbabwe, for that is where King Lobengula came. When his father, King Mzilikazi, left Natal, he was told, go out north, you will come across a singular mountain. That mountain is in the midst of a flat plain. It has two little nqeles on either side, small little hump mountains. That is where your people should be. And when they finally got together there and came there, and he came and he saw that my people have arrived. But the king arrived late. So by the time he arrived, the local chiefs had enthroned and crowned his son, Gulumane. The king said, how can one son be there when another son has not risen? So it has huge impact and importance on us. That is why myself and the late chief protected the Parsons on that mountain, because they kept it well as custodians.
It's a tourist attraction too?
It could be a tourist attraction, okay. Baba. It hasn't yet come to that place.
Okay.
But for us, what we are saying is that we, the local people, are happy and comfortable with the Parson families being there. They have worked with us. They are family. We regard them as family.
Are they still there?
They are still there.
Okay.
And we are still protecting them there, and we'll continue to protect them.
The government wants them out. You're protecting them.
Yes. So for us, really, we're saying it is us who should determine who lives on those particular areas. But then again, it's not the Parson family only. We have a number of other families that have come to me, like my good friend David Jube, who's got a huge farm at Inyati there. He also was awarded this farm by the High Court, by the Appeals Court. And at this very day, Trevor, this very day, when all those courts have given a man a farm, you have the ZRP, Zimbabwe Republic Police, taking over the farm. Obviously, that's an issue. That matter is before the Attorney General. There are talks, there are conversations. But that is why when I came out and made that statement that infuriated some people, when I said sanctions should remain, it is from that impetus I took that statement to say, if an individual's property is not their property, what law are we relying upon? Because if David Jube went from the Magistrates Court, the High Court, the Appeals Court, and all the other courts, and won and won and won and won on all those levels, and then the political arena comes in and say, we're taking over that, someone has to stand up for those people.
So your standing up for those people has made you a target as far as the government is concerned?
I should probably say so, yes. Part and parcel of that. But I think it's a principled stand. It's a stand on principle to say that even in your place, Baba Trevor, where you live, you've bought it with your own money. It is yours. It is your place. There should be no one, no matter what position they are in the government, who should be able to come over and say, I'm taking it away from you. I'm not even bothered to say the Parson families are white. It's irrelevant to me. Completely, thoroughly, totally irrelevant. It is the principle I'm after, to say they have a legal right. They have a proper right there. It is justice.
You've also been outspoken on Gukura Wundi.
Yes.
Could that also be a problem, that an issue that has caused this seeming conflict between you and the current administration of President Mnangagwa?
Yes. I think you are right there, Trevor, as well. You are right. The Gukura Wundi, as it's called, for myself, I prefer the term Ndebele genocide, because it has been ratified as that in all reasonable academic arenas and the likes internationally. They've classed it as a genocide. It is difficult for me to see how this country can move on if such a thing has not been dealt with, and dealt with by seriously. We must deal with it in a judicial way. There's no escaping that. There will be people incarcerated. There will be people put in front of judges and juries and the likes for it. Because it has brought out the G word.
Genocide.
Genocide. It is the G word which humanity has said, when you bring that word out, that means people have done the most heinous crimes known to mankind. Now, when you have that kind of thing in us, in Matabeleland land, how do you ignore that?
So how do we move on from where we are now, as far as that G word is concerned?
The only way to move on, Trevor, with this particular area, is to follow the well-established routes of investigation, establishing the truth, putting the proper things in place, putting the legal framework in place, and yes, calling up individuals who've been identified as having taken part in this thing, dealing with it in that particular way. In that process, there will be a place whereby forgiveness and the likes will come in. But it is the victim who determines this roadmap. It is not the perpetrator. When I hear people talking left, right, and center, and some people saying, Baba Ndweni, some of our perpetrators are sitting in government today. How do we move forward with that? We have to put it in a legal framework.
We need to find closure.
We need closure on that, Baba. And we cannot get closure if someone chooses to say, well, let's just do a truth and reconciliation committee. That does nothing. That touches us nothing. It is absolutely nothing. In fact, some people would call it an insult.
In any case, who should decide how we proceed? The victims or the perpetrators?
It has to be the victim. On all those scores, it has to be the victim who determines how we move forward with this whole thing. And I would say to those who are maybe worried that they'll be viewed as perpetrators, do not be worried. Do not be worried at all. Present yourself to the victim. Present yourself to the law. Present yourself to justice. Present yourself to be judged by your peers.
And I talking to David Coltart, we've had him on this show. And David Coltart interestingly says, most of what the victims want is to hear, I am sorry, to be forgiven. They're not even asking for compensation. Is that your sense?
That is the sense that is there out there, Trevor.
Yeah.
A huge amount of it is that. But that huge amount only comes in after they've passed the initial phase of the justice, the truth-telling. It is the truth-telling and the justice that comes in, which gives the victim the power to say, what do we as a society do to the perpetrator? Your house has been burgled. It's been burgled. You caught sight of the burglar as they made their way out with your expensive phone, your videos, your cars, your everything, and they went down the road and disappeared. You go to the local police to make a police report. I saw him, description, this, and this happened. It went this way, particular way around there. Now, how would you feel, Trevor, if the police then says to you, no, Trevor, we know where he stays. Let's put you together with him so you can reconcile. You went past the pawn shop down the road and you saw your phone being sold off. So part of your property is gone. And the local police is saying, no, Trevor, let's mediate between you and the thief who disturbed your whole peace. This is the connotation I'm bringing
over.
To say, we need to deal with that part first. And then the reconciliation, the likes, will follow afterwards.
What are the prospects of that happening?
I think the prospects are very, very high. Why do I say that? Because the issue of the Ndebele genocide is now quite strong in the international arena. There can be no conceivable solution to the Zimbabwe problem or issues, whether you're talking about economy or the right to vote or all the myriad of things that have gone wrong in Zimbabwe. Those will be addressed at some point in time. But also in the midst of that would be this issue that would be addressed. So we're coming up very, very closely to it. So really, I'll be saying to people that if you're worried about the economy and how things are expensive and things like that, those things will be dealt with in attached some way, some form, to the issue of the genocide thing.
You're also passionate about the restoration of the Ndebele monarchy. Speak to me about that.
Oh, Trevor, you're throwing heavy issues at me. But yes, no, I am indeed. I'm extraordinary.
Let's have the conversation.
I'm extraordinarily passionate about that.
Why?
Because in our country, we recognize 16 official languages, which means we have 16 nations in Zimbabwe. Nations that have a culture, a dress code, poetry, music, cuisine, have everything that defines them as a nation. In many places when I go around, I say I hate the word tribe because it undercuts you. It somehow says you're incomplete. That's why I say nations, and that's why I've said on many platforms, Zimbabwe is a nation of nations. One of those nations happens to be the nation I come from, the Ndebele nation.
Are you making progress in the restoration of the Ndebele monarchy?
We are making huge progress. Outside of Zimbabwe, Inkosi yam, my king, is recognized officially all over the world. I accompanied him when we went to Blantyre, Malawi. We were officially invited by the United Nations Women section and also the African Union Women's section. So we're sitting there in the conference hall, and he was next to me, and his card said, His Majesty, King Bulelani Khumalo, sits here. Next to him, Inkosi Nhlanhla Yamangwe Ndweni sits here. So in the international arena, he's already there. We've already crowned him. We crowned him way back already. He exists. All that is left is for him to come here to Zimbabwe and assume his rightful role within here. By me supporting my monarchy in this particular way, I'm not excluding other monarchies. If from where you come from culturally, you had a monarch, I will support you to get your monarchy up because it is the embodiment of you.
Are you doing that?
Yes, we are.
Okay, as a national movement of the restoration of our old monarchs?
Yes, we talked with a number of monarchies, different groupings there. The Mambo dynasty are also there. We've talked with them in the past and the likes. And we've said we've got no issue with you. Go ahead and resurrect your monarchy. But also we will do it with our monarchy in that particular. So it's not an either-or situation. It is a completeness of it. And for me, it is something more than that. Because I truly believe that when the War of Liberation came through, that War of Liberation, Trevor, was not about twin cabs and getting a farm. It was more than that. And that more than that is the very thing we're talking about. Your culture, your traditions, your monarchy, your everything there.
Your sense of belonging.
Yes, of belonging and the whole thing. So that you, as a son or as a daughter of the soil, can stand your own ground if you find yourself in New York, in Paris, in Berlin. It is about that. It is that depth I'm after.
Let's talk about the small issue of you having a suspended sentence of 18 months for having destroyed property that belongs to one of your subjects. Where is that matter now? You laugh.
I laugh, Mama, because it's something which has been played in the media so much so. But really, it is a non-entity. This case took 2 years and 4 months to proceed in the Magistrates Court. It was involving a cultural issue. A woman is found to be having an affair with a neighbor by her husband. The husband finds her in the act, in the bushes. The husband comes to the chief to say, Baba, into le singayenza kanjani. into le yangiduba kakhulu inkosikazi itholile egangeni lomakhelwane kumele siyibambe ngesintu siyiqondise ngesintu.
Do you want to translate that briefly?
Yes.
Yeah.
Translated that he came to me and said, Chief, I found my wife in the act. I need this matter to be dealt with traditionally, culturally. I need the in-laws to come in to sort it out and to see how we can do it. And so we came into this issue and we said, well, we need to do a little counseling between the pair of you. The wife needs to go back to her people for counseling to see whether she wants this marriage or not. Maybe she doesn't want this marriage anymore. Same with you, Baba. You need to have counseling amongst your kin to see whether you want this marriage to work. They agreed on that. But the problem came in was that when it came out that the lady in question is a lady who associates with the ruling party. She's a party member there, and they felt aggrieved by that. So they said, ignore what Chief Ndweni says. Do not do it. And so we said to her, you have to do it. Otherwise, there are penalties which come from the traditional court, because the traditional court is a recognized court in Zimbabwe. So you must do what this court says. It is for your own good. Mm-hmm. Go and get some counseling. Mm-hmm. She refused. And then the husband also joined her because the political pressure from outside became big. When they both refused, we said, well, okay, we will now take ownership of the garden that we gave you as a community. Because if you are living in communal lands, everything belongs to the community. You do not have a title deed for that land. So we removed some bushes from her garden.
And that's the crime that you are allegedly committed.
That is, Trevor, the malicious damage to property.
Where is that case now?
It was done in the magistrates. We lost it there. I was sent to jail, Kami prison. My lawyers came out and fought it. I was released from prison for that. And my lawyers said to the judge, for heaven's sake, the value of the property we are talking about here is no more than $20. How do you jail someone for 18 months for $20 if it was malicious damage? And my legal team said it was a nonsense. So the legal team is still fighting it. They've gone to appeal. And I have every faith that they'll totally wash it out.
Okay.
Because it had no merit whatsoever. It was inspired by the political arena. And that's how it came in.
The role of chiefs has been politicized.
Very much so.
To a very large extent.
Very much so, Baba. Very much so.
And you explain to us why you would find it proper to attend a political rally and make political statements. Aren't you playing right into the hands of people that say that are saying the role of chiefs has been politicized? You went to an MDC rally. You made statements that upset some people.
Yes.
Talk to me about that.
Yes, they were upset. I think my understanding of the role of a chief is with a view of a modern age. Earlier on, I spoke about how a chief is in charge of absolutely everything in his domain. Instinctively, that means that that chief needs to speak with everybody. Everybody, irrespective of who you are, the chief needs to speak to. To date, I have spoken with the current president, who is president today. I spoke to him when he was vice president. I have spoken to many ministers in the current administration on a day-to-day basis. Indeed, I've even attended their own political rally.
You have attended a ZANU-PF rally?
Yes, and Mzingwane. I attended it there for them. So I said to them, what is all this ballyhoo about me going to see Chamisa and Gweru? I went to you first. So it's neither here nor there. And I've hosted the majority of leaders.
Why is this happening, Chief? Explain to us.
Trevor, it is happening because it is coming from a new arena. It's coming from an institution that has been silenced for so long. The institution of traditional leaders should be the fallback opposition in government here at every time because they should be non-partisan. They should not get involved in politics. Which I have not done. I've never got involved in partisan politics. Even when I've gone to whether a ZANU-PF rally in Mzingwane or an MTC rally at Gweru, I've always spoken as a chief and brought over issues that trouble chiefs, because in my jurisdiction, I'll have some of my subjects who are ZANU-PF. Some will be ZAPU, some will be MTC, some will be People First, some will be everything. Mm. All those political parties, I need to know what they stand for. What are they bringing to my people? Mm. And yes, I have hosted Joyce Mjuru at home. I've had Dumiso Dabengo at home. I've had Nelson Chamisa at home. I've had the late Robert Mugabe at home. We have drunk tea together and talked. That is the role of a traditional leader. Mm. Obviously, from the political arena, people are looking at it with a partisan eye. Mm. That partisan eye does not work. Mm. The institution of traditional leaders has to be the fallback position in any government. Mm. It has to be the thermometer that gauges what is that government doing, mm. where is it going, what is happening. If the opposition of the week is, if the opposition of the day is weak or is challenged, the institution of traditional leaders in the House of Senate should be the one that says, look at that law again. Does that law look after women? Does that law encroach in a particular area? Mm. It is all those issues. So for me, that is the way I look at the role of traditional leaders. And actually, that is the future. For myself, I would like to see a situation whereby the institution of traditional leaders does not have a minister of local government at its helm. Why should I respond to Minister of Local Government July Moyo? Mm-hmm. He's not a chief. He knows nothing about my chieftaincy. Mm. He knows nothing about how I work. Mm. The minister for chiefs must be a chief, sitting on his own, must not be mixed up with local housing. Mm. I don't want to be part of local housing. Mm. The traditional structure must be made anew.
So you're basically arguing for the strengthening of traditional structures back to our culture, as it were. Is that what you're arguing for?
I'm arguing about that, Baba, whereby I'm saying, let's bring it into the modern arena, yeah, whereby yeah. I'm saying the minister for chiefs must be a chief. Mm. We must be by ourselves.
Depoliticized.
Depoliticized there. That minister for chief must sit in the executive and argue for a budget for us so that we have all those things in-house. Mm. It is then that we can depoliticize this institution. Mm. It is then that we can answer all the things that we need to do. Mm. Because on the one hand, the law of the country says I must not get involved in politics. And then it makes my boss a politician.
What a contradiction.
You can't have that.
This is the time to leave politics. Shall we go to...
You are
an amazing chief.
Yeah, yeah.
You love sci-fi.
Ah, brilliant. Brilliant. Yes.
Brilliant. You love brilliant. Game of Thrones.
Yeah, wonderful.
Tell me about that.
Trevor, don't you like sci-fi?
No, I don't.
There, you're lost now.
Where does this come from?
Sci-fi, I've always loved it.
Yeah.
It is great. It is beautiful.
Right.
It relaxes the mind. It gives you time to think. Mm. It takes you away from the humdrum of day-to-day things. Mm. It's a nice release whereby you're trying to just use your mind to say, is that possible? Is that whole thing there?
And your favorite is Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones.
And what else?
Star Trek Generations. Mm.
You've watched the whole...
I can lock myself up from Friday afternoon.
You do binge watching?
Binge watching Friday afternoon, and you won't see me until Monday. That's what I was doing before I came here. They were saying, Dwayne's gone.
Yeah.
He's gone. He'll come out again there. No, for me, it's great. I love it. That's my forte. That's my whole thing. But also, if you look at it in a different way, how do we know that there's nobody out there? Every time when we send a rocket out there, how do you know that it's not going to arrive there and go, knock, 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 mankind is here?
Right.
It's those things. And even if I want to go a bit deeper with my passion for sci-fi, you're a man of letters, you're a man of faith. Where does your faith come from? Mm. You are believing in something many other people can't touch. A person who's an anarchist or agnostic would not be able to touch your faith, Trevor, and say, you believe your faith, but you believe it.
Deep issues.
Deep issues. Mm. So it's about just bringing all those things in to say anything is possible.
And you love basket weaving.
Yes.
Wood carving and painting.
I did the painting in my A-level here when I was here in school in Falcon. And then the wood turning, which is wood turning, making wooden bowls and things like that. I learned when I was there in the UK. Now I'm a member of the arts and crafts movement overseas internationally. So I'd like to have time to bring all that back in. I haven't had time to do it since I came back to Zim because really this started a whole new career for me. I thought I was going to have time on my hands, but I haven't. I've got the reverse. So when it comes to wood turning and basket weaving and crafts, these are the things that I know in my community people can make a livelihood from.
Do you have time after you've finished binging on sci-fi to read books?
Yes, I do.
What books have you read of late that you'd recommend to our viewers who love reading?
It's a book that I didn't read quickly, and I know many people have read it prior to this. When it came out, it's an old book, and the person responsible for this book is now late. And I'm talking about Thabo Madiba Mandela, The Long Walk
to Freedom.
It's a book I've been reading over and over and over again, for the simple reason that, once again, it brings humanity into the question. To say you've been incarcerated for 27 years. How is it that you come out and you're not foaming with anger? You're not lashing out. You're not doing all those things. How is it that you want to build a rainbow nation when you come out of that incarceration? It gave me an insight. It gave me an insight to say, you know what? We need to accept that we are different. There are no two people the same. Even twins are come out different. We need to take a step back and chill out a bit. The political arena in Zimbabwe has become so toxic. People are so angry. Yes, I can understand the anger, because life is hard. You're buying a bag of mealie 50 kg for 600-700 bond when your salary is only 200 bond. So I know people are angry, but in the midst of that anger, still I would insist, take a step back. Take a step back. Chill out. Go back to the family. Go back to the important things in life of saying how we can do this thing together. I've just come here to you today, Trevor. Last night I didn't sleep because I was looking after 2,000 little chickens. The electricity ran out on me. I had to look for candles and look for this and look for that so that the little things don't dry away. Those are the important things in life to keep us up and going.
Wow.
Yeah.
Chief Felix Nhlanhla Yamangwendweni. What an amazing conversation. I'm hoping that through this conversation, a lot of people that might have misunderstood you got to have a sense of who you are. We appreciate our
Thank
chiefs.
You,
you remind us of where we've come from. And we should never forget where we come from. So we thank you so much for flying all the way from Bulawayo to join us for this conversation. So thank you. Thank you so much. And for you at home in the diaspora, all over the continent, we hope you enjoyed watching this conversation with Chief Ndweni. We invite you to visit our YouTube channel and subscribe to the channel so that you don't miss out on these amazing, fascinating conversations. We learn so much. Until next time, cheers.